Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in Korean Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Leslie Hickman, one of the channel's hosts. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Sana Laybourne about her new book, Out of Place, The Lives of Korean Adoptee Immigrants. The book was published by NYU Press in January of this year. Dr. Laybourne is assistant professor of sociology at the University of Memphis. She received her PhD from the University of Maryland in 2018, and her areas of interest include race and ethnicity, identity development, Asian America, and Asian Americans. Her book explores the experiences of Korean adoptees, the largest population of adult transnational adoptees in the United States. Over 125,000 Korean children have been adopted into primarily white U.S. families since the 1950s, and despite being raised as U.S. citizens, still experience both legal and social barriers to national membership. Dr. Laybourne explores how adoptees navigate and reconcile these refusals of belonging. Okay, most of that was appropriated from your own synopsis, but Sana, I'm very excited. Yeah, I'm very excited to meet with you and learn more about your book.
Well, I am so excited to be here. I can't wait for us to have just a great conversation about this book and really just dive in.
Wonderful. Okay, so if you would dive in with giving us some more information about yourself, that would be great, and we'll get into the questions.
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, I'm an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Memphis. And I think most pertinent to this conversation, of course, I have, you know, the credentials and my area of expertise being racial and ethnic identity or race and ethnicity more broadly. But I think what else is really relevant to this study in particular is that I am a Korean adoptee myself. And that definitely has shaped how I've approached the work and also the importance of the work that I see beyond, you know, some of the maybe methodological or theoretical contributions and broader implications in a scholarly arena, but also personally in thinking about Korean adoptees as a group and thinking about what can this book do for other adoptees who are maybe still, you know, looking to connect with other adoptees or just curious about how is it that I ended up, you know, in the United States and maybe not connected to other Korean Americans or not connected to an adoptee community. And so for me, I think it's also important to situate, you know, myself as a scholar, but then also not just as a scholar, but as a person.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you for that. So to dive right into the questions, in your book, you write that Korean adoptees possess something called exceptional belonging, and I was hoping that you could describe this a bit more for our listeners.
Absolutely. So in the book, I talk about exceptional belonging as this process and also this phenomenon of, in this case, Korean adoptees, but I think it could be applicable to other groups as well, being culturally constructed as belonging and being very, you know, special and exceptional in the ways that they belong, but then also simultaneously being constructed as not being able to ever fully belong. And so I talk about in terms of both media, but also policies. And then, of course, those on the ground experiences that adoptees have of feeling as though they are, you know, special and unique in belonging in the United States, but also never able to fully feel a part of the national body.
Hey, many adoptees are socialized into white families and align themselves with the ethnic reality of those white families. And yet they experience public racialization outside of these family circles. So could you describe some of these racialized experiences and also how these adoptees respond to them?
Mm-hmm. So most Korean adoptees are adopted into white families, and so they're raised as white family members. And so I talk about in the book that family belonging and racial belonging is intricately linked for these transracial, transnational adoptees. And so on one hand, Korean adoptees feel as though their family members like any other. But on the other hand, they experience these instances of public racialization that remind them that you are not white and that the way you should be expected to be treated should not be through the same experiences that maybe your family members have. And so oftentimes these are direct experiences of interpersonal racism, of people telling them, calling them racial slurs or telling them to go back to where you came from. Experiences that for some Korean adoptees are very jarring because they think about themselves as, you know, white family members as Americans. And so it's on one hand can be very confusing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, some adoptees, you know, are understanding themselves as members of, you know, Asian America, as Korean Americans, and understand what that means in terms of the racialized social structure of the U.S. And so there are a few different ways that adoptees respond, you know, some, you know, kind of just brushing it off, others through confusion, and then some others also even pushing back against these experiences of racialization. And then the other thing that I think is important to note is while there are instances of public racialization, so from strangers or even other community members, adoptees are also experiencing this within their own families, right? So being raised as if they are white, as if they are just simply family members, but also within that socialization, being made to feel that there's something a little bit wrong with not being white. And so sometimes this can come in very implicit ways through perhaps how Korean culture is not incorporated into their lives or how Asian Americans are missing from, you know, their social networks or the activities that their parents expose them to or involve them in. And then other ways, even direct comments from family members that have very anti-Asian racist beliefs. And so there's both that public racialization happening outside the home, but then also I talk about in the book that private racialization that's happening in the home as well.
I remember there was this bit where you spoke about a Korean adoptee who she felt like someone liked her, a non-Asian liked her in her school. And when she mentioned it to her parents, they're like, oh, maybe you should, like, you know, stay within like mm-hmm. your own race. And so I thought, wow, that was really fascinating to still have that. The parents still had that idea of like, oh, you're like us, except you're also not kind of like us. So that was really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially in that dating age, I give a few examples in the book from adoptees who kind of, you know, took their Asianness for granted and because that's how they were raised. But once they got into that dating age, then they started to see the racial attitudes of their parents really come out, like the example that you mm-hmm. gave and then several other that were similar where it became clear that, oh, you know, my parents do see me as something different than white and they're having these expectations about who I should partner with through that racialized lens of you are not white and therefore you should be partnered with someone who is not white.
Okay, wow. To go into my next question, you describe legal obstacles that threaten adoptee citizenship status and even their ability to stay within the country. These obstacles are reflected in the case of Adam Krasper. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Could you tell us who Adam is, what happened to him, and how the conversation surrounding his case impacted Korean adoptees?
This is such a great question because Adams' case really brought renewed mainstream attention to international adoptees without citizenship. And so in 2015, you see New York Times Magazine and a lot of other mainstream media picking up this case of Adam Crapster, who is facing deportation. So he's a Korean adoptee. At this point, he's, you know, an adult with a family, with children of his own, and he wants to renew his green card. And when he does that, his background check is flagged because of prior crimes that he had committed, that he had, you know, been found guilty of, that he served time for. But because of changes in our immigration laws, even though he had already served time for these crimes, he was now eligible for deportation. And so I think, one, this shows how our immigration policy changes all the time in ways that put immigrants in a precarious position, right? So previously, when he committed these crimes, when he served time, those weren't deportable offenses. But because of changes in our immigration legislation that retroactively now say that within certain classes of felonies or certain violations, they're now deportable offenses. So that's one piece of it. And then the other piece directly related to his adoption was that at the time that he was adopted, there was no policy or there was no legislation that actually dealt with and directly addressed the citizenship status of adoptees. So adoption and immigration are two separate legal policies and legal pathways. And so even though he was legally adopted, he was never naturalized. So that was a separate process that his adoptive parents should have completed on his behalf, but they did not. And so he found himself in a position similar to many other adoptees who have already been deported, and also potentially tens of thousands of international adoptees without citizenship. And in Adam's case in particular, he ends up getting deported during the holiday season of 2016. But what his case was able to do was bring mainstream attention to this citizenship loophole that many adoptees are falling through. And it also gave a case to get people really galvanized around to push for a legislative fix.
Hey, yeah, I remember you said one of the crimes that he committed was just breaking into his old foster or his own adoptive home to like get some stuff back that they wouldn't give to him.
Yes,
so I think it also adds a layer to the story. For my next question, why are Korean adoptees still not able to achieve citizenship, even if they've been in the U.S. since they were infants and they were legally adopted, but they're still not considered citizens? So what kind of legislation is in place that perpetuates this illegal status? And conversely, you also mentioned some legislation that has passed to recognize adoptee citizenship in some ways.
So if we think about when international adoption from Korea in particular first began in the 1950s, a lot of these young children were adopted under a variety of different visas and through different immigration pathways, some even being able to immigrate under current refugee immigration laws or refugee immigration acts. And so, again, we have this legal adoption happening, which is one process, and then we have naturalization, which is a completely separate process. And there were no laws that actually merged those processes for international adoptees until the Child Citizenship Act of 2000. And so when that piece of legislation was passed, then it did retroactively grant U.S. citizenship or naturalization to any international adoptees who were under the age of 18 at that time, and then all future international adoptees, as long as they were adopted under the visas that were covered under that piece of legislation. But as you can imagine, there are thousands of adoptees that were left out of that legislation. So that passed in 2000, but adoption from Korea in particular had been happening since the 1950s. So there are decades worth of international adoptees who would not be covered under that legislation. And if their parents didn't know that their children weren't naturalized, then there was no legislation. There is still no legislation that would ensure their citizenship. So it puts international adoptees in a very precarious position. For a lot of folks, when they hear this, it's completely mind-boggling. And as you can imagine, for families, it's also very confusing. You know, you adopt this child and that's your child, right? You're like, this is my kid. And for U.S. citizens, you know, birthright citizenship. We think about citizenship as being passed down through family, but that's just simply not the case for international adoptees, or hadn't been the case for several decades.
So is it the case now, or is it, are there still some stipulations? Like, it's kind of the case, but not really. I don't know. Could you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Child Citizenship Act of 2000 did ensure that international adoptees adopted after that piece of legislation went into effect would have naturalized citizenship. But it still left those who were over the age of 18 when that legislation passed without a pathway to citizenship. And so that's where that loophole comes in. And that's where Adam falls through the cracks as well, because he was over the age of 18 when that Child Citizenship Act of 2000 was passed. And there aren't any hard numbers on how many international adoptees are undocumented. There are estimates anywhere from around 35,000 or more, and that's just thinking about Korean adoptees. But again, there aren't any hard definitive numbers, but we do know that a few dozen international adoptees have been deported. And this is certainly an issue that we could very easily fix with some policy changes, but it's very uncertain if that will actually ever happen.
Okay. My next question is about Korean adoptees sometimes join social groups and programs when they meet other Korean adoptees. So how does getting to know people with similar backgrounds and experiences impact adoptees, both positively and also maybe ambivalently? I think you had some examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a lot of Korean adoptees come to find these existing Korean adoptee social groups later in life. Mm-hmm. And so this can be both a very exhilarating experience, right? An exciting experience to find folks who have a similar background, similar personal history to you, and connect with them. And this can also be an experience that can be very stressful, especially for adoptees who grew up without any connections to any other Korean adoptees, or without even knowledge that Korean adoption is a global phenomenon that has been happening since the 1950s. But in fact, there are Korean adoptee groups throughout the United States, and also in Europe and Australia as well. And many of these groups have been in existence for over two decades or more. The advent of the internet greatly impacted and assisted Korean adoptees in finding one another, as it did for a lot of other groups that are often hidden from each other or even marginalized groups. And so for Korean adoptees who are able to connect with one another, there is an experience, or there is a feeling of, you know, finding your people or finding your group. You know, as humans, we all have a desire to find that sense of belonging, that sense of space and place where we feel like we belong, that these folks understand us. And particularly for Korean adoptees who have often been made to feel as though they were out of place in terms of how we often think about race or family or national citizenship. So for some adoptees, it is very empowering. For other adoptees, it's also very alienating. I think there is a lot of expectation when you're meeting, you know, for Korean adoptees, when you're meeting other adoptees, there's can be an unfair, I would say an unfair expectation that, oh, we're all going to think the same, or we're all going to have similar experiences. And of course, that's not the case for any group, right? And so for some adoptees, it can feel very jarring to not have a lot of shared, you know, attitudes or shared beliefs. So it runs the gamut, just like with any other large group of folks. You know, everyone is not going to be the same. But I think it still provides adoptees a way to think about their experience a little bit differently.
I remember you also mentioned this sort of feeling they had, that complicated feelings they had about doing Korean things together, like they should enjoy it because of their Korean heritage, going to Norebang, for instance, going karaoke, or having Korean food. Of course, like, it's hard not to like Korean food, but it's still like this expectation. It's like, oh, is this mine actually? Like, yeah. So I thought that was also like a really interesting thing for them to explore as they were like in these groups and enjoying those. Yeah. Okay. So my next question is about the last chapter, Flying Through. You write about two documentaries and one film that surround the experiences of Korean adoptees. So what are these films, and what was the adoptee community's response to these films?
So let me talk about the, so I talk about, as you mentioned, three films. So Twinsters and AKA Soul are both Korean adoptee created media. And then I also talk about Blue Bayou, which is Korean American created and directed film that is about or portraying a Korean adoptee experience. And so I want to talk about Twinsters and AKA Soul first, since those are about Korean adoptees, created by Korean adoptees, and they are documentaries. You know, Twinsters, for a lot of folks, you know, because it was released on Netflix, it was often a way for both adoptees and non-adoptees to really first encounter a Korean adoptee story. And I think that's really the power of a mainstream platform like Netflix, is that you get to capture a lot of folks who, you know, aren't adopted or maybe didn't know they were interested in anything adoptee related, but they were interested in this film of two people who were separated at birth and then find each other, you know, later in life, which, you know, is so fascinating. And I think we all have this genuine interest in twins and, you know, how alike are they? And that question of nature versus nurture, which is all explored in Twinsters. AKA Soul is a docuseries that was released on ABC Asian America. And again, a broader audience than just an adoptee audience or, you know, a Korean adoptee audience. And what I like about AKA Soul is that, again, it's not just an adoptee story, but these very universal themes of kind of exploring yourself, kind of figuring out, you know, who you are, but also enjoying travel since it is filmed primarily in Seoul. And so you also get a sense of Korea and a little bit about some food and just different experiences that the adoptees are having while they're in Seoul. And they're actually there for a Korean adoptee international conference. And Twinsters also features this conference a little bit in it as well. What I loved about Twinsters and AKA Soul is, or especially Twinsters, I'll say, is that Twinsters, you see a direct effect of folks, adoptees in particular, watching Twinsters for the first time, learning about an international Korean adoptee community, and then deciding, hey, I want to go to this conference that they went to, right? That these two twins went to in this documentary. And so I talk about in the book how at that conference, the International Korean Adoptee Association's conference, in that next conference in Korea after Twinsters airs, a lot of first-time attendees are there because they saw Twinsters. And I think that's just a very powerful impact of media in a positive way, mm-hmm. of having Korean adoptees see themselves represented in this documentary and connecting directly to the community. And so that I find very empowering and very hopeful. Blue Bayou, on the other hand, so this is a mainstream film or a limited release in theaters. Blue Bayou follows the story, the fictional account of a Korean adoptee who finds out that he's not a naturalized citizen and then is potentially going to get deported. What's interesting about this film is that it very much mirrors Adam Crapser's case, and it's coming out, you know, kind of a few years after Adam's very public case. And in fact, Adam himself says that Justin Chan, who is the director of the film, had reached out to him after he saw his story being covered. And so for adoptees, there was this question of appropriation of Adam's story. There's this question of, do adoptees have, you know, kind of the power and the right of their own story. And so I think this media moment offers a lot of lessons and opportunities and also challenges, because for Korean adoptees who have been in a part of advocacy around undocumented adoptees, there was this sense of Justin has appropriated Adam's story and we should boycott this film. And I definitely think that's one approach. On the other hand, for a lot of adoptees who saw this film and they weren't aware of an adoptee community or advocacy or even maybe directly Adam's case, for a lot of adoptees, I heard them say, like, wow, like, I really connected with this story, right? This did represent kind of some of the experiences I've had. And so I think it also just goes to show that, you know, media serves different purposes and the way that it can touch different audiences, depending upon your existing relationships or your existing experiences, can differ very broadly.
See, I also see, because I'm more study Korea side, I've seen some Korean dramas where they depict adoptees who've returned either from the United States or elsewhere, and the hardships that they can face. I think one was he was also deported. So I thought, oh, this is really interesting. So the Korean side as well has some, I suppose, criticism or about, where these adoptees end up belonging or struggling to belong. So yeah, very, very interesting issue. The usual adoptee narrative follows that adoptees were unwanted by their home countries and should feel grateful to live in the US. And this goes along with the conference you just spoke about. So how do adoptees' visits to Korea and attendance at the International Korean Adoptee Association impact their understanding of this narrative that they're unwanted and allow them to take back some control?
Yeah, this is a really great question. I talk about in the book these narratives around, as you mentioned, adoptees growing up feeling as though they were, thrown away or unwanted or rejected by their home countries. And that's certainly a narrative adoptees actually hear from their adoptive parents, from, other family members, from media more broadly. And so for some adoptees, it can be a big challenge to actually go back to their birth countries, to actually return, right? For some, they feel like, well, that country didn't want me. Why would I want them, right? Why would I want to go back? But I think what I find and what I talk about in the book is how Korean adoptees, once they go back to Korea, and not all, but many adoptees who do go back, they feel a sense of belonging, right? And of course, it's not a simple magical moment for everyone, but for many adoptees, they come to understand a little bit more in depth about Korean history, about what led to international adoption, but then also being able to explore their home country on their own terms gives them a sense of agency to reclaim that piece of their story. And oftentimes, what adoptees shared is that them actually being back in Korea and interacting with Koreans, it gave them a completely different view of that story of being unwanted, of that story of not having a place or a home in their birth countries. And so for some adoptees, it can be very revolutionary, for something that you had believed or heard a story of being unwanted, and then to go back and find that, wait a minute, there is a place for me here. And of course, it's not perfect because nothing is, but it's also not what I was raised to believe.
I wondered if you would be able to tell us about your personal experience. Did you have a coming back to Korea time, or did you how have you navigated your identity, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask throughout this time.
Yeah, that's a great question. So in Out of Place, it's not a memoir, it's not an autobiography, but in many ways, it is still my story since it is about Korean adoptees, and I am a Korean adoptee. I talked about how we see actually a few hundred adoptees going back to Korea and attending ICA for the first time because of Twinsters. For me, my first time back to Korea was actually when I was in undergrad. And I think this speaks to the importance of study abroad programs and the importance of having, supportive teachers or professors. I first went back to Korea as an undergrad, and it was simply because I had seen these posters around campus saying, discover Asia, study abroad. I had heard a guest speaker talk about how important it is to know your roots and to know where you're from. And she wasn't even talking about, Asian Americans or Asians. She was actually a Black woman speaking to Black Americans. But just, I guess, hearing it in that moment, really resonated with me. And then seeing the poster, discover Asia or study in Asia, it was like, oh, this is my opportunity to go to Korea. And to be honest, I'm not sure that I ever really imagined that for myself. And so it just happened to be kind of like the alignment of everything happening at the right time. Because for me and my story, like many of the adoptees I talk about in the book, I kind of learned that exploring Korea was not something that I was supposed to do. And that was nothing directly said to me, but, our parents or our family or our community silences also say a lot. right? Mm-hmm. And also, and for me, as someone who, no surprise, a lover of books, a lover of reading, as a young child, I remember going to the library and looking for books about, you know, Korea or about adoptees, and I didn't find anything. So I also learned, right, through all these different little lessons that there wasn't any information, or this was something that I shouldn't or couldn't be curious about. And so it was, you know, again, in college, by the time that I'm actually really actively exploring this idea of what would it mean mm-hmm. to go back to Korea. And I'll just say, for me, the approach I took was, I'm going to, you know, do this semester abroad. I don't want to have any preconceived notions or any expectations. I just want to go and actually experience it, right? Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting because once I told, you know, family members, church members that, hey, I'm, you know, going to do this semester abroad, all of a sudden it seemed like everyone in my life was an expert on Korea.
Oh.
They had so many warnings and so much information about how it was going to be and what the experience was going to be like. And I'm like, wow, I've never heard you all say anything about Korea, you know, my whole life. And now mm-hmm. all of a sudden, it, you know, everyone had all of these opinions and advice. And again, what I decided to do was, I wasn't going to, you know, incorporate that into my imagination of this semester abroad. I just wanted to go in and just experience it. And for me, I will say, like some of the adoptees in the book, once I got to Korea and kind of even, you know, off the plane into the airport, it was a feeling of like, wow, I'm home. To see so many other people who looked just like me was a comfort that I didn't even know that I had been looking for or that I had missed. Because for me, I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, an extremely small Asian American population. Mm-hmm. And so it was very different for me to be in Korea again and just see Korean people everywhere. Like I distinctly, even now, you know, decades later, still remember, you know, seeing Korean bus drivers and seeing just Korean people who were, you know, cleaning up the street. And that actually made such an impact of just Korean people just being people versus, yeah, just going about their lives, doing regular things, versus my experience growing up, again, in Memphis, in a place where I was very visible because I wasn't white, I wasn't Black. And so to be in Korea and to just be able to exist was something that was just so empowering for me at that time. And I'll just say, you know, I was attending ICA. So the conference, it happens every 3 years in Seoul. And so it just happened last year in 2023. Mm-hmm. And I remember leading up to that trip, for some reason, I wasn't excited. I love to travel, but I wasn't excited. I don't know if there was some sort of resistance happening emotionally or just subconsciously. And I've been back to Korea a couple times since that time in undergrad, but I just wasn't excited. But I will say this, as soon as I got off the plane and again, walking through the airport and you're about to walk through the doors that actually lead you out, you know, mm-hmm. and I describe it as my entire body started to smile. It's like I just felt like that sense of I am home. And even if I didn't, or up until that point, hadn't been thinking about that intellectually, it's like in my body, I felt this excitement and that sense of I'm home.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, that's a great way to end. I do want to know what else, is there anything you really want the listeners to know about the book, if nothing else, like what is something that maybe we haven't covered that you're like, I want people to know about this part of the book?
Yeah. I mean, for me, what I would love for readers to take away from Out of Place is the ways that we are all a part of these ideas of race making, of family making, of even national belonging, and really contemplating how we contribute to the many ways that folks feel out of place, and not just Korean adoptees, but we can think about other groups as well. In the book, I talk about, of course, you know, media constructed narratives and policies as well, but then also there is that interpersonal level, those interpersonal interactions that are also shaping our worldview and our sense of belonging. And so I think think we have a lot of personal power there that we can also leverage for advocacy on a broader level. So, of course, in the book, I talk a lot about advocacy around undocumented adoptees and citizenship rights. And I think that issue of undocumented adoptees who are undocumented immigrants can also broaden our understanding to think about undocumented immigrants across a variety of different groups, and hopefully can help us think about or rethink what we want citizenship to mean or what citizenship should mean, and how we can think about equity for a variety of different groups beyond just the adoptee experience. So I really hope when folks read Out of Place, it helps them think through some of these bigger ideas of race and family and belonging, and then ultimately also, you know, get involved in some way. Yes, through our own, changing our own personal attitudes and talking to the people in our direct networks, but then also on a broader level, how can we get involved in advocacy and action to actually change things on a systemic level?
Great answer. I certainly, when I read your book, I thought about some things I've said in the past. I grew up sort of like the same situation as you, very small town. It's very mono-ethnic, except I was in the majority. And so when I went to university and I said, like, there were all these international students, and I was really excited because I was in the anthropology program. So I was like, yeah, I love culture. But I think back a lot on like when I was first there and some things I said to people, including I had a Chinese or a friend from who was adopted from China. And so I thought about her a lot whenever I was reading this, and some ways that maybe I like othered her a bit, like mentioning China. So I really appreciated your book and the things that I could do to perhaps like change, you know, my own personal interactions. And yeah, I think it is definitely a good book that will help people to sort of see the world and citizenship in a broader, maybe new light. Great. So that's all I have for you today. You've been really fun to interview. And
thank you.
Oh, but if you would like to let the audience know, like, is there anything you're working on right now that we can look forward to maybe in the future?
Oh, yeah. So a while ago, I heard this little nugget of information that said that post-Japanese internment, you know, a lot of PWIs did not accept those Japanese American students to complete their degrees or to even to start, you know, a new degree. But HBCUs did, or some HBCUs did admit Japanese American students. So again, writing that direct post-internment period. And that always stuck with me. I think it was a grad student when I read this somewhere, heard this somewhere, and I wondered, you know, to what extent, you know, that was true. And so right now I'm digging into the archives at Fisk University, which is in Nashville, Tennessee. So right up the street from where I am. And it's such, you know, good luck that it is at Fisk where I have found that there was a Japanese American master's student in the sociology department right in that post-internment period. And so I want to see, you know, how were Black Americans thinking about Asian Americans, this Asian American question during that time period, and also really investigating, you know, how might our discipline, our field of sociology, have been different if we would have thought about Black scholars and the ways that they were thinking about race, and of course, Asian American scholars as well, and the way they were thinking about race kind of in that time period. And so that's what I'm really interested in right now, is kind of diving into that and seeing, you know, what else I can find, and, you know, helping us think through, you know, what might our entire field's approach to race, racism, ethnicity have been like if we would have rooted our foundations in Black scholars in particular, and then Asian American scholars as well, and their ideas about race and racism.
Great. We'll look forward to that. Maybe have another interview in the future.
Yeah.
Okay. And so take care. That's all. Those are the questions I have. But this has been Dr. Sana Laybourne about her new book, Out of Place, The Lives of Korean Adoptee Immigrants. All right. Have a great day.
Thank you, too.